Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
All right. And it says we're now recording. It says Slate slow burn, 8 seconds. Here we go.
Steven Engelberg is the editor-in-chief of ProPublica. Back in 2001, he was the investigations editor for the New York Times. One of his reporters was a Times veteran named Judith Miller.
Maybe a couple of weeks after July 4th, 2001, Judy came to my desk and she said, "I've got an amazing story. We've got to go. We've got to go fast. This is really astounding stuff." And I said, okay. So what do you got?
What she had did sound amazing. An intercept of a conversation between two members of Al-Qaeda.
And the first guy says something along the lines of, "It's really a shame the United States did not retaliate for the attack on the USS Cole," which was an American ship that had been attacked by a sort of suicide bombing dinghy. And then the second guy says, "Well, don't worry, we're planning something so big they're going to have to retaliate."
Miller had been covering Islamic extremism for years. It seemed like she might have a huge scoop. Plans by known terrorists to launch a major attack against the United States. Engelberg was interested. But first he needed to know where the story came from.
"So what do we know? I mean, who are these two guys?" And she said, "My source doesn't seem to know." Where are they? What country are they in? Are they high level, low level? Are they just two guys talking, you know, in a bar?" Of course, they're Al-Qaeda. They're not in a bar, but I was sort of speaking metaphorically.
Miller didn't have those answers, but said she'd try to find out more.
She came back and said, "I just can't get any more detail on this. This is what we've got. Can we write a story?" And I said, "Judy, I just don't see how." I said, I see paragraphs 1 and maybe 2, but what's paragraphs 3, 4, and 5? We can't do it."
The story never ran. 2 months later, Al-Qaeda hijacked 4 planes and killed 3,000 people.
And of course, you know, after 9/11, we both sort of at some point caught our breath and talked about this and sort of thought, wow, what if we had done the story? You know, would it have changed history? Were they really onto this thing? Was it just a coincidence? What was it?
And do you feel like if you'd let her run that story, Bush might have paid more attention to that baby?
Who knows? You know, I just didn't think we had enough.
There are 2 ways to think about the decision to spike that story. The first, this is exactly how journalism is supposed to work. An aggressive reporter got a tantalizing bit of information. A careful editor pushed back to make sure it was properly sourced. It turned out the story just wasn't there. So the New York Times didn't publish it, and the paper's journalistic standards were upheld. The second way to think about it, the New York Times could have had one of the biggest scoops in history if they'd pushed harder to get it. Or, maybe, if they'd gone to press with something that wasn't 100% buttoned up. You can even imagine a scenario where the paper prints a story and helps prevent the 9/11 attacks. Journalists have to balance 2 competing ideas. Get the biggest story you can before the competition does, but also make sure that what you're publishing is true. Sometimes they end up being cautious, and big news never makes it into the paper. Sometimes they're aggressive, and that can cause its own set of problems. In the run-up to the Iraq War, almost no one was more aggressive than Judith Miller.
Why did I believe the people I believed? Why did I believe the people who talked to me and not the people who wouldn't? Because these people, by and large, not all of them, but most of them, had been the very same people who were warning us about Al-Qaeda and 9/11. I had every reason to believe them because they had been right before. I got it wrong. I got it wrong because I believed people who also believed themselves.
This is Slow Burn. I'm your host, Noreen Malone. If you read the New York Times in 2002 and 2003, you probably believed the Iraqis had weapons of mass destruction. In the year before the invasion of Iraq, the media mostly backed the administration's narrative about WMD, even when the evidence was thin. So how did the press get the question of WMDs so wrong? Why did so many reporters end up looking so credulous? And why was Judith Miller the one who took the fall? This is Episode 7, Judy.
Hi, I hope you've been enjoying listening to Slow Burn. The last two episodes of this season are available only to Slate Plus members. You can sign up by going to slate.com/slowburn or clicking on the link in the show notes. It's only $15 for your first 3 months. With your subscription, you also get access to bonus Slow Burn Plus episodes with extra interviews and stories from behind the scenes. And your membership lets you listen to every Slate show ad-free, not to mention gives you unlimited access to Slate's website. So to hear the rest of this season of Slow Burn and become a member, go to slate.com/slowburn or click the link in the episode notes. Thanks for supporting our work.